to fulfill all of the needs that they have. This is why it brings them together in societies. And then, you know, he continues and says that this leads to conflict of interest in some cases. There becomes a need for a law. And then ultimately this leads to the delegation of the prophets and revelation. In continuation, the Imam says, but he ensured its management by diversifying their aspirations so that everyone performs for others that which is compatible with his own capacity, in order for some of them to be served by others and for their conditions to be sound. So this, you know, this we come together, they work, they do what they can for one another, so their conditions can be sound, and you know, society can function and move and progress towards its felicity, both in this world and in the hereafter. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at employment and livelihood in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has carried out a series of strikes on Gaza, killing at least 13 people, including 4 children. 3 members of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement and their families were also among those killed. The Ministry of Health says at least 20 others were also injured in the pre-dawn strikes. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have also intensified their crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the reasons behind this escalation. We have with us Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joining us live from Beirut. Also, Chris Williamson, host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, joining us from Derby, from the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of Spotlight. Let's begin with Laith Maarouf. We have received different reactions from resistance groups, of course, all of them vowing to retaliate. Do you think that we could actually expect a united retaliation as it has been discussed. What kind of retaliation would that entail?
Well, we've heard statements by all the resistance groups in Palestine saying that they will be retaliating. So now we know at least inside Palestine there is a unified front. Much of Israel right now, at least the what is called the Gaza envelope, has been either evacuated or under lockdown. The schools are closed in the Zionist colony tomorrow. So what we should be expecting is the same as the Zionists are expecting. The Zionists are expecting a heavy blow as a response to this treacherous assassination of Islamic Jihad leadership in Gaza, that it will be something that will be felt across Israel. There's even the bunkers in Tel Aviv have been opened right now. So this gives us a hint where we're going.
Okay, now before we discuss how Israel will react to that, let's bring in Chris Williamson. Mr. Williamson, how united do you see the resistance front in Palestine? We do know that the Achilles heel for any resistance would be to not be united in their fight for whatever the cause there is. And, of course, the divide and rule policy is something that has proven to work. The name of the game here would be solidarity and unification. And how much do you see that among different Palestinian factions and resistance groups?
Well, first of all, let me say that this is yet another brutal response by the Israeli regime. And, you know, it's a time for the international community to stand up and to speak out against, I mean, you know, this continuation of turning a blind eye is totally unacceptable. But in terms of the resistance, you know, from what I've understand the situation to be from the various programs that we put on Palestine Declassified, we know that there's unprecedented unity now across Palestine in terms of the resistance, the kind of axis of resistance as it's known, right across all the different factions. So, you know, one of the things which I think, you know, the Israelis are finding difficult to come to terms with is the effectiveness now of the resistance and the ability of the resistance to strike back. And I think we will certainly see a response from the resistance to this latest brutal atrocity by the Zionist entity.
Okay, so Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, why does the Israelis attack, when they attack these targets, why don't they consider that there might be women and children there? Is this something that they do on purpose? They want to have women and children killed as well? Or is this some kind of collateral damage?
You know, the Zionists are brutal ghouls. They are blood hungry. They talk about our peoples in our region as if they're tribal. But in reality, if you see how they purposefully target the family and children of leadership in Palestine, meaning that they want to cut off the bloodline of a family. That is the most tribal and most vicious thing you can do. Also, it is important to note that these three leadership of Palestinian Islamic Jihad were on their way to Egypt. They were invited by the Egyptian negotiators who are mediating between the Zionist colony and Palestinian groups in Gaza on the release of an exchange of prisoners. They were invited by the Egyptian government to arrive in Egypt today, and they were supposed to leave the Gaza border at 9 o'clock in the morning, meaning the Zionists knew where that they will be doing so. And the Zionists saw that they are gone to see their families, to say goodbye to them before they go to Egypt, and they took advantage of that and assassinated them. So this is as vicious as the assassination of General Soleimani, who also was arriving to Baghdad on invitation of for negotiations of peace. So this is what the Zionists do. And finally, one last thing to say here is one of the civilians that were killed, other than the children and women, was the general chief of Al-Wafa Hospital, a very famous doctor in Gaza who headed at one point the Dentist Association, and he's a dual citizen, a Russian-Palestinian citizen. This was a very, very vicious attack, and it will receive a response very soon from the Palestinian resistance groups.
So, Mr. Williamson, Netanyahu has just said that they are prepared for any kind of scenario. On the other hand, we do know that Tel Aviv is now warning settlers living near the Gaza Strip to stay close to bomb shelters in the coming hours because, well, obviously they fear that there might be retaliatory rocket attacks from Gaza. What does this mean when he says we are prepared for any scenario? If they have to go into shelters, that really doesn't mean to be prepared for a scenario. It just means running away from it.
Well, I think that's another indication, frankly, of the precarious state of the Zionist entity and the effectiveness of the resistance. We've seen and heard from very senior figures in the Zionist entity who have talked in terms of the regime and the whole Zionist edifice actually, you know, crumbling. You know, very senior figures, former Prime Minister, have said that you know, they fear that the Zionist project could end before the end of this decade. So I think, you know, the brave talk from Netanyahu, but, I mean, the reality is that, you know, the tide of history is against them. The effectiveness of the resistance is growing. International opinion is increasingly critical of the Zionist regime. And I think that, you know, the writing is on the wall, frankly, for a substantial change and the, you know, the fortunes of the settler colony there is very much in doubt now. And, you know, what we need now, of course, though, is to push our politicians in the West to actually, you know, recognize that they are supporting the last brutal apartheid regime on the globe. And, you know, we know that there was a huge opposition around the whole of the world in opposition to the apartheid regime in South Africa. And that was, you know, in the end supported by Western countries who previously fallen in line and supported the South African regime. And I think, you know, given the strength of public opinion in all Western countries now is moving in favor of the Palestinian cause and Palestinian liberation, will force the politicians to change their tune and to actually recognize that they, you know, they need to be supporting a change in the whole situation there, which is completely untenable and has been going on now, as we know, for 75 years. Completely appalling. And, you know, we've got to keep the pressure up. That pressure is happening on the ground in Palestine, of course, but we need to be doing what we can outside of Palestine to continue to support the resistance there.
So, Mr. Maruf, these strikes in Gaza, where does this leave Egypt as a country that has been trying to mediate? You just brought up the name of Egypt, and you did mention that negotiations were supposed to be underway before this happened. So where does that leave a country like Egypt who's trying to solve the issue through diplomatic means? Then you see such kind of reactions from Israel. You have a long list of UN resolutions that are being neglected by the Israeli regime, not to mention that most of the actions by this regime are against the international law and international conventions.
Well, clearly the Egyptian government had made a statement condemning this assassination. We know that the Egyptian negotiators were really upset and sent a stern a response to the Zionists. They know that they have been put in a really bad situation now. The groups in Gaza now can refuse the negotiation efforts of Egypt. Since the morning, the Egyptian government has been trying to outreach to Palestinian Islamic Jihad, clearly to maybe ask them to not retaliate, but they have not been getting any responses from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And remember, Egypt, like the rest of the Arabic League, we're moving towards ending hostilities between Arabic states and realigning themselves together with Syria and having a separate foreign policy, as we see the Saudis are attempting to do that too, from the United States and Israel. And already Egypt is in the heat right now with the manufactured war in Sudan that the Israelis and the Americans instigated to make sure that even if Egypt at one point decides to have a sovereign foreign policy, that it will not be able to deliver on it, having a ring of fire spanning from Libya to Sudan, cutting it from its surrounding and making its economy suffer with millions of refugees coming from Sudan.
Okay, so, of course, the regional developments are also very important in considering the situation in Sudan as well. We will discuss that later. But meanwhile, Mr. Williamson, do you think that Israel has left any room for diplomacy with its actions? Or have we reached that point of no return where it is now proven to any observer that once and for all that the only way to fight against Israel is the resistance of the Palestinian factions, and there is actually no room for diplomacy left?
Well, I think that's been the case for a good number of years now. I mean, the Israeli regime has always negotiated in bad faith. We saw that with the Oslo Accords. The reality is they were never interested in self-determination for the Palestinian people. But the tide, as I say, is turning. And, the resistance is becoming more effective. The BDS campaign is ratcheting up. We've seen now the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran brokered by China. China is now a much bigger player on the international diplomatic scene, as it were, taking the place, frankly, of the United States of America, which, historically has always been supportive of the Zionist entity and continues to be so, bankrolling them to the tune of over $4 billion every single year. But the U.S.'s influence on the international scene is certainly waning. There is a new world order developing. We're seeing different powers coming together, the link between China and Russia and Iran and other major players coming together in the BRICS, as it's known. And, this is, I think, a very significant development, which can only augur well, I think, for the future in terms of a multipolar world. We're moving away very rapidly from the unipolar world. I think the unipolar world is gone anyway. Now we are already in that multipolar world with, as I've already mentioned, the influence of China now. And the interesting thing is, China approaches its kind of its foreign policy developments and the way in which it conducts itself on the international stage, does it in a way to try and, bring about peace and to try and, as it were, mutually developed nations rather than the sort of gunboat diplomacy that we've seen from the likes of the United States of America and the United Kingdom and others in the Western world. And things are definitely changing, in my opinion. But as far as diplomacy is concerned with the Zionist entity, I think they've never negotiated in good faith. And I think they need to be forced, frankly, now to bring about the change. And as I think, that's already happening, as we've already said, with the resistance on the ground and pressure building from outside as well.
So, Mr. Maruf, you just heard Mr. Williamson's analysis of the recent developments as far as the political equations of the region is concerned. And, of course, with China playing a more important role in the region. And how do you see the situation of Israel in the near future, maybe in the next 10 years?
Well, hopefully it will not be in existence in 10 years. It's clear that we are at the beginning of its collapse, and that comes, of course, coupled with the collapse of American hegemony and imperialism. Remember, I just want to put this out here. I don't think any pressure will change the minds of the leadership in the West about the Zionist colony. And that is because if the Zionist colony collapses, then the Western Empire will not be able to project its power over Asia and Africa and control the trade routes that are important there. It will be actually an acceleration of collapse of American imperialism. And this is why somebody like President Biden years ago said that if there was no Israel that was created by the Zionist movement, that the United States would have created it itself. So given those realities, we must understand that the only way to liberate Palestine is through direct confrontation with the Zionists and collapse of it under the pressure of resistance. There's nobody that's going to come to save the Palestinians, and there will be no Western negotiators to bring down the Zionists from the tree. This will be a battle to the end, and this is very important to understand, because if the Zionists were rational, or the imperialists were rational in terms of this issue, then we wouldn't see actions like we saw today. The clearer and closer we are to the liberation of Palestine, the more and higher possibility there will be of irrational actions by the Zionist colony and its backers, and as we see that happen today.
And of course, let's not forget that Israel has been raiding the flashpoint city of Nablus, or the raids on Ariha, other parts of the occupied West Bank. So, Mr. Williamson, why is Israel attacking these parts of the occupied West Bank as well? Is it trying to deviate attention from its internal affairs?
Well, I think certainly that is part of the reason. I'm sure it is. But also, of course, that, you know, they want to try and crush the resistance. But it's a forlorn proposition. I don't think they're capable of doing that. And, you know, we've seen how the resistance pushed back the Israeli ground forces a couple of years ago when they were seeking to another incursion into Gaza, and, you know, the resort to these brutal air raids. But, you know, I do think that external pressure does have a part to play. Of course, in the end, Palestinian liberation will be delivered by the resistance on the ground. But I think external pressure can play a part. And of course, the imperialists who hold sway across the West at the moment are determined to, you know, maintain that position for the reasons that Maarouf outlined. And we saw what happened when, for example, Jeremy Corbyn, who the leader of the opposition, the Labour Party in Britain, was within a hair's breadth of becoming the Prime Minister. Massive effort was put into destroying him and destroying his supporters. And, you know, that whole Corbyn legacy now has been utterly destroyed now within the British Labour Party. The Labour Party is nothing like it was under Jeremy Corbyn's tenure, because Jeremy did threaten that world order. He was somebody who was very supportive of the Palestinian cause and had been for decades and has spoken out numerous times in the Houses of Parliament in Britain. He was also in favour of peace on the world stage. He appointed a Minister for Peace and Disarmament, and, you know, we'd have had the prospect of Britain being a permanent member of the UN Security Council, promoting peace and disarmament around the world rather than war and arms sales. And that was unconscionable. Even Mike Pompeo, you know, the Secretary of State in the US, said words to the effect that, you know, they would not allow Corbyn to become Prime Minister. So there was certainly external interference there. So yes, of course the imperialists will do whatever they can, but the pressure is growing from the populace, as it were. And, you know, and these politicians are subject to election in the so-called Western democracies, and there is every prospect. I know that the Corbyn project was destroyed, but, you know, those people that were inspired by that haven't gone away. And so there is the prospect, I think, of getting new politicians elected to bring about the sort of revolution that, you know, we were hoping for under Jeremy Corbyn. And that's being replicated, you know, right across Europe and indeed in the United States of America as well. So I'm not, you know, totally pessimistic about the role of external pressure. I think it has a role to play and can actually help to hasten the demise of the Zionist entity. But look, as I've already said, you know, when you've got people like Naftali Bennett, the former Prime Minister of Israel, talking about, you know, the precarious nature of the Zionist entity, and other senior figures, you know, predicting former Prime Minister Barak talking about, you know, being ended within 10 years. I mean, they see the writing on the wall, it seems to me. So, you know, we need to obviously support the resistance wherever we can, and those of us who, you know, are not in Palestine, continue to put pressure on the policymakers to do whatever we can to, you know, up that and increase that pressure, that external pressure. Because that did, let's remember, play a part, that external pressure did play a part in actually bringing down the apartheid regime in South Africa. So, you know, we shouldn't be totally pessimistic about that, but we need to be realistic, I think, as Maroof has set out, but not actually give up on putting pressure, external pressure, to hasten that demise of the Zionist entity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chris Williamson, host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, joining us from Derby in the UK, and also Laith Maroof, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thanks for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight and sharing your thoughts and views with us. That brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how can I get rid of nightmares? In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salaam alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me today. We're going to start our program today with a kind of weird question, and that is, my dreams are nightmares. Would you please show me a cure for my bad predicament before my youth wastes away? Some people may suffer from this problem, so we're going through the answer. So we know some dreams, as psychologists have proven, are a reflection of one's psychological worry during wakefulness, during the day. So, to cure yourself, you have to follow the principles I'm going to offer in this session. Firstly, and I think the most important one, is to purify your daily activities from unlawful things. And if something unlawful takes place, purify it by asking Allah for forgiveness. Because if we commit an unlawful action, we feel guilty. And feeling guilty has got a ruining effect on our soul and our heart, and it makes everything as a nightmare. And secondly, we need to be satisfied with what Allah has given you, wealth, beauty, health, and the like. Thirdly, perform ablution before sleeping and recite a portion of the Holy Quran. And when you lie in your bed, think of what you have recited or try to sleep while thinking good thoughts. It is also a very practical principle that if someone wants to get rid of nightmares, must follow this principle as well. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for the second part. So we were talking about the ways of getting rid of nightmares, and the first way we offered was to purify our daily activities. And secondly, we need to feel satisfied, and we need to be satisfied with the blessings of Allah, with what Allah has given us, from wealth, beauty, health, and the like. And also, it's very important, if you're suffering from nightmares, to perform ablution, wudu, before sleeping, and if it is possible, to recite a portion of the Holy Quran. And when we want to sleep and when we lie in our bed, we need to think about what we have recited from Quran, and also try to sleep while you are thinking about good thoughts. But fourthly, if we want to continue the principles that we can get them through Quran and Hadiths, that is to be certain that those who have been happy in their lives have faced problems too, and that their lives are not free from troubles now. But they are well aware that worrying is a problem much greater than those problems. So why would they increase their troubles by worrying when they need to decrease them? Nightmares come from feeling worried during the day, and there is no reason for feeling worried, and we need to decrease this feeling by relying on God and by following His principles. Fifthly, and the last one, we need to remind ourselves of our good actions and successful deeds, and do not think of our failures and shortcomings. Everyone has bright pages in his life, and even the successful and great people are not free from defects. Dear young man, dear my brother, dear my sister, set out in the way towards Allah the Almighty and rely on Him. This is the only way we can rid of our nightmares during the night and during the day. I hope everyone a life without nightmares. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in seven free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the seven free industrial and trade zones.
Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc. have also been conducted.
There are 7 active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zone's productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar free zone.
Chabahar free zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the third energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors.
Customs and transportation services are much better in the free zones. Also, there are better investment opportunities there. Aras Free Zone is one of the 7 free zones in Iran. This zone has been very successful in industrial activities as well as agriculture.
Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large.
Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Srinagar, which is the main city of Indian-administered Kashmir, has been given a significant facelift, something that has not happened in decades. Roads are freshly finished, sidewalks fixed, cycle tracks laid, and new colorful signboards placed. All arrangements came after New Delhi-backed administration announced that it will host G20 meeting sessions in Kashmir. Now authorities say G20 meetings have come as a blessing to Srinagar's developmental projects.
We are at a very advanced stage of most of work in many of our projects. Similarly, what we are also doing is that we have started working in the double shift. So in the night also, the work keeps on going. So with the same intention that this progress of the work should speed up. Now, G20 came as a boon to us. It's a good opportunity for us to further speed up. And I think it has helped us in overall, pushing our work on top gear and helping us better coordinate and making sure that we complete many of these projects at a much faster pace.
The projects which were in a wait list for the past 5 years have been completed in a matter of no time. The citizens have appreciated the pace of the work but are criticizing some aspects.
For the people living in Srinagar, these projects make no sense. We wanted road widening for the ease of transport in the city center. Instead, they've shrunk the roads and broadened sidewalks. The administration is yet to make its decisions clear to the citizens. They've just made parts of Srinagar as a showpiece.
They have dug up the entire city and we are really fed up. There is no plan for the city. The businesses have been strongly dented. We are a tourism-based economy, but tourists are not even coming this way. So what sort of smart city planning is this? This is public money and people have not been taken on board.
India is expected to host 215 meetings at some 55 locations this year. Following India's move, Pakistan has accused India of exploiting its membership in G20 to advance its, quote, self-serving, unquote, agendas. However, India has called these decisions as internal matter. The meetings will be the first major international event held in Kashmir since Narendra Modi-led BJP government scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous special status in August 2019. The legislations divided the Muslim-majority region into 2 federally administered territories.
The stage is all set and Srinagar is all ready to host the G20 meetings.
Experts say G20 meetings in Kashmir is an opportunity for India to display the return of normalcy in the conflict-ravaged Kashmir. However, people of the region say New Delhi's good work in Kashmir must not revolve around the G20 meetings alone. It must move beyond and look for the larger good of people who have suffered for decades. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida became the first Japanese leader to visit South Korea for a bilateral summit after 12 years. Despite ongoing historical disputes, President Yoon has reached out to Tokyo with plans to possibly include Japan in its alliance with the U.S.
Washington.
Both countries are exposed to North Korea's nuclear threats, and the military cooperation is needed more than ever. The Washington Declaration at the moment is an agreement between South Korea and the U.S., but we do not rule out the possibility of Japan's participation.
Japanese Prime Minister Kishida sought to reassure South Koreans over the impending release of contaminated water from the 2011 nuclear disaster. He also welcomed the opportunity for Japan to participate in a network of military alliances.
North Korea continues to carry out provocations in the region, and there is a sign that there is an attempt to change the current status by force. Based on this assessment, we agreed we have to strengthen deterrence and ability to respond to threats through Japanese-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-Japanese alliance, and the trilateral alliance.
Both supporters and detractors rallied outside the presidential compound. Many opposed President Yoon's outreach to Japan and militaristic pro-U.S. policies and questioned his patriotism.
Is President Yoon Suk-yeol, who is driving the Korean Peninsula towards Cold War confrontation while taking the lead in representing the interest of the United States and Japan, is he really the president of South Korea?
South Koreans have also been critical of President Yoon for creating a South Korean foundation to compensate victims of Japan's colonial rule. Improved relations between South Korea and Japan will no doubt be welcomed by the U.S., which wants to see a strengthened trilateral military alliance. And despite domestic opposition, President Yoon seems fully committed, with the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated to start later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know, Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why are many mainstream platforms? So what the royal family stands for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Showing absolutely no remorse. These are the confessions of the man that led the Harakat al-Nizal separatist group, responsible for several terrorist operations in Iran that left over 450 casualties in a span of 15 years.
According to our plan, our members received military training. That is because we wanted to give the impression that Harakat al-Nizal is strong and can carry out military operations. We even started our activities with an attack on the governor's office inside the city in a residential area.
Based on the theory that the end justifies the means, the Swedish-backed terrorist ringleader masterminded one of the deadliest terror attacks in Iran. In 2018, the attack on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz killed at least 25 people and injured 70 others, many of which were civilian onlookers.
You could say that all of those who were killed or injured in the attacks were ordinary civilians. We really didn't care. Even many of them were Arabs, and that was okay. We just wanted everyone to know about us. We want people to know Harakat al-Nizal.
The Harakat al-Nizal terror group has been pushing to separate the southwestern province of Khuzestan, which is home to Iran's Arab population.
Arab, Turk, or Persian. We are all Iranians and we will always remain united.
I took part in this funeral to show my support for the Islamic Republic and our leader Ayatollah Khamenei. We are one and nobody can divide us.
Today, I came here to send a message that we will always remain united.
Habib Farajullah Cha'ab, nicknamed Habib Osaivand, head of the terrorist group, was arrested in 2020. He stood trial in 2022, where he pleaded guilty and was convicted and sentenced to death. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence, and he was executed on May 6th. His mission remains a failed plot. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
A vigil was held in Gaza denouncing the latest Israeli crimes in Nablus, which led to the killing of three Palestinian men and a woman. Israeli occupation forces raided Nablus city on Thursday morning and assassinated three freedom fighters. Israeli army claims that the victims are responsible for the resistance operation in the Jordan Sea last month. People from all walks of life in the besieged Gaza city came out in solidarity with the West Bank against the Israeli regime's atrocities, confirming their utter support for the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank.
Those who were killed by the Israeli occupation were defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and killing them in cold blood is a war crime committed by the Zionist criminals. These crimes would only increase the Palestinian resistance actions and strengthen their unity against the occupation forces.
Al-Ghul insisted on the unity of the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza and the West Bank.
We urge the Arin al-Usud resistance group and all freedom fighters to unite. We are with you from Gaza, the 1948 occupied lands, the West Bank, and even from outside Palestinian territories in Lebanon and Syria. We are all awaiting the leader Mohammed al-Deif's commands to start battle and free Palestine.
On a separate incident, the Israeli forces murdered a Palestinian woman in Hawara town in Nablus. The assassination raised the death toll of the Palestinians to at least 102, including 20 children so far in 2023. During the vigil, people chanted slogans in defiance of the Israeli occupation and called for retaliation.
The Palestinian resistance is much more experienced against the Israeli occupation. They started with nonviolent approaches and then raised the bar for the Zionist enemy due to its brutality against the Palestinians. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank learned lessons from what happened in Gaza and are now following their footsteps. The Israelis know that the resistance is now invincible. They are certain that the resistance is able to bring them down, especially when the Netanyahu cabinet faces serious challenges in the occupied lands.
Tensions have been escalating in the West Bank in the past months. The Israeli army has intensified its operations into the Palestinian cities and towns, during which they arrested and killed tens of Palestinians. The Israeli regime commits human rights violations and war crimes on a daily basis against the Palestinian people across all Palestinian territories, and with every crime, it knows that it becomes harder to restrain the Palestinian resistance actions. Ulal Asi, Gaza.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages across the 27-nation eurozone will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about $1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience, or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Limelight.
U.S. banking crisis has deepened. PacWest is the latest American bank to see its stocks plunge following the collapse of several rivals. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reuters reported shares of PacWest Bank Corp dragging other regional lenders down after the Los Angeles-based bank's plan to explore strategic options sparked investor worries of a widening financial crisis. PacWest stock slumped more than 40% in afternoon trading, dropping to a record low. The bank had confirmed an earlier Reuters report that it was exploring strategic options, including a potential sale or capital raising. First Republic's collapse, the third major casualty of the biggest crisis to hit the U.S. banking sector since 2008, rekindled a slide in shares of regional lenders, despite regulatory efforts to stanch the turmoil that began with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in March. U.S. officials at the federal and state levels are assessing the possibility of market manipulation behind big moves in banking share prices in recent days, a source familiar with the matter told Reuters. According to RT, regional lender PacWest Bancorp has become the latest American bank to be caught up in the worst crisis in the sector since 2008. The bank has confirmed it is in talks with potential partners and investors about the strategic options, following a 60% stock route. Shares in the bank nosedived in after hours U.S. trading recently over reports the Los Angeles-based lender was mulling a sale. PacWest shares were down as much as 48% in early trading recently. The bank has not experienced out-of-the-ordinary deposit flows following the sale of First Republic Bank and other news, PacWest stated recently, adding, "Our cash and available liquidity remained solid and exceeded our uninsured deposits." According to the lender, discussions with potential buyers and investors are ongoing, and the company will continue to evaluate all options to maximize shareholder value. People familiar with the matter told Bloomberg that PacWest has been considering a breakup or a capital raise. A buyer would potentially have to book a big loss, marking down some of the bank's loans, sources said. PacWest sell-off followed U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's announcement that authorities were closer to containing the turmoil that has gripped the banking sector. Powell claimed that the government seizure and sale of a struggling First Republic Bank of J.P. Morgan Chase was an important step toward drawing a line under that period of severe stress for regional lenders. First Republic became the fourth U.S. lender to collapse this year, following Silvergate Capital, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank. Meanwhile, chief market analyst at KCM Trade, Tim Waterer, told Bloomberg that the Fed's statement offers little in the way of confidence for the market. Despite the best efforts by Jerome Powell to calm the market, there is nothing to suggest that the banking crisis is at an end, he claimed. Meanwhile, there are reports that two more U.S. regional banks saw trading of their shares suspended recently amid the worst crisis to hit the country's financial sector since 2008. Regulators halted trading in Los Angeles-based PacWest and Arizona's Western Alliance after their share prices fell dramatically. PacWest Bancorp said recently it was in talks with potential partners and investors about the strategic options after its shares dropped by as much as 60%. The bank announced recently the company has been approached by several potential partners and investors. Discussions are ongoing, but investors were not reassured and the sell-off continued. PacWest shares fell 50% and affected other regional banks. Western Alliance plunged 45% before trading was halted. The bank's stock has shed more than 60% of its value so far this year. Another mid-sized bank, First Horizon, lost almost 40% of its value recently after Canada's Toronto Dominion Bank Group scrapped its planned $13.4 billion takeover of the lender. We are running out of time to fix this problem. How many more unnecessary bank failures do we need to watch before FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and our government wake up? We need a system-wide deposit guarantee regime now. Bill Ackman, the CEO of the New York